previously.tv podcast network.
I need a name, son. Who are you? What's your name? We got no records of you. Come on. What's your name? Can I cut your tongue? You can tell me. Nothing, huh? All right.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 212 for the week of July 23rd, 2018. I am vacuum-sealed coffin David T. Cole, and I'm here with 80s Easter egg Sarah D. Bunting.
Sometimes dead is better.
Texas husband killer Tara Ariano.
Well, he never put the dog treats away.
And Craggy, retired local law enforcement officer, Dave Roth.
Are you up?
Welcome to another Extra Hot Great. Joining us this week is a brand new guest. I have been lucky enough to do his podcast with him, Dave and Jeb Aren't Mean. He is, of course, the Dave of Dave and Jeb. Dave Roth, welcome.
Hello, hi, Dave.
Yay!
Wow. Thanks for having me.
We are here to talk about Hulu's latest original series, Castle Rock. And before we get into it, Dave Cole, can you please describe what you were expecting slash hoping for from this this project?
Yes. Okay, so picture it. Cujo is driving Christine to go fight Maximum Overdrive while Misery looks on and sort of like clocks a loser with a sledgehammer. Like, I wanted every single Stephen King property, character, situation to exist simultaneously. Whereas this show is basically the Stephen, as Tara said to me, this is the Stephen King Fargo. I wanted Stephen Kingdom Hearts, like the Disney RPG video game where everything exists at the same time. Not that I was disappointed with the product. You know, the show I find interesting in its own way, but the Stephen Kinginess of it all seems to be past history. There's BK and AK, and this show takes place AK after King.
Yeah.
And the King properties haven't really showed up in the show. They're just all mentions of things that happened in the past. That one time when the dog went crazy and the other time, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's just like mentions of it. But I was really hoping for sort of a cornucopia of Stephen King stuff all happening at the same time.
And like some Bachman stuff happening like in the background. I was sort of hoping that The Longest Walk could be like taking place like in the distance, like on a road behind them out of focus. No, not yet anyway.
So Dave Roth, we gave you a number of choices of upcoming shows, and it was basically this or Mr. and Mrs. Miz, the wrestling show on USA. We went with this. Do you regret this choice that I semi-foisted on you?
I mean, relative to the fact that I could have been a wrestling like relationship reality show with zero Stephen King fan service, I think this is probably the best case scenario.
Did you like it?
I liked it pretty well. I mean, I like Stephen King stuff fairly well. I like Maine. My wife is from there. I think of it fondly. It's terrible, all the monsters they have, but it's a wonderful place to go on vacation. But it was weird. I mean, I didn't know what to expect from it because I hadn't really, like, the television Stephen King universe is less familiar to me than, you know, like in the 90s when there were two Stephen King movies a week. Yeah. I watched all of them, but I haven't seen like Under the Dome or this sort of like the new prestigier television King iterations.
Did your wife watch it with you since she is?
No, I wish that she had. I was telling her about it. She's on she has a work retreat this week, so she did not get to see it, but she has a special issue. She bizarrely was homeschooled in Maine by two people with Maine accents until high school and then went to high school and was taught by people with Maine accents, which she has none of. But she gets very upset by bad Maine accents in television and film. And this And yeah. This one is just like watching the fucking slam dunk contest over and over again with them. Like the people that attempt it, like poor Francis Conroy is just like, I'm going to Portland to buy you some shorts. Like it would, like I could feel my wife getting angry from like the weird retreat facility that she's at now with all her coworkers, like a disturbance in the force.
Well, I did watch all of Under the Dome, as listeners of this podcast well know. Oh. So the bar that this had to clear in terms of not as bad as Under the Dome, I would say it did clear it. It's not a terribly tall order, but I thought this was interesting. So the story is we're at Shawshank Prison. There's a new warden because the last one spectacularly killed himself. And there's also some elements of like this is a private prison company and the old guy didn't care for it and they're trying to pass off his suicide as like, well, some people aren't suited for retirement. Like, yes, but but when they're exploring the facility, they find that there's a wing that the now dead warden kept empty for 30 years. And when they go down there, they're discovered there's a cage in it and there's a guy in the cage and the guy is Bill Skarsgård. So, you know, he's up to no good. At this point, he's a veteran of the Stephen King-iverse because he also played Pennywise in last year's It feature film. And for having lived in a cage for all that time, I mean, it didn't do anything bad to his cheekbones, I'll say that, because he does look otherworldly, but he doesn't look bad. But he also isn't really talking. The only thing he says is Henry Matthew Deaver, who turns out to be not his name, but the name of... now death row lawyer played by Andre Holland from The Nick, and he is from the town and he comes back and stuff happens because he also has a sketchy past. And I thought this was all like on the line of prestige enough to be interesting, but not, I didn't feel like it was trying too hard to not be what it is, which is a summer spook show. Sarah, what was your thought?
I felt like it was a little, there were some things that irritated me about it, but your assessment just now is right on. Like I felt that it was, you know, effective at building atmosphere. I like a lot of these actors. I am starting to wonder if Terry O'Quinn's agent requires when he is cast in something that his role involve ponderous flashbacks with the absolute most garbage wig available. Like, can't he just have been bald in the past and you give him like a little rouge or something from the 90s instead of like these, like he looks like Dog Boy with this shit anyway.
It's also amazing that even when Terry O'Quinn was young, he was bald. Like in like The Stepfather, he's balding. Right. Like the idea that like you just slap some bangs on him, like that's never been a vision of Terry O'Quinn that anyone has seen.
Yeah, like there was never a bang. Like if you find him in like his black and white kindergarten picture, he's like that and probably has the rimless glasses as well. But aside from that and feeling like at times they're sort of like, you know, burying the lead a little too far, given that I believe the drop schedule for this is that they put out the first three and then it's a weekly.
I think that's right. Yeah.
So it's like, okay, like get to it. Like, just tell us at least by sort of like the middle of episode two, enough with the portentous flashbacks, like just give us more so that we know the nature of this big bad who apparently is the kid. I only watched two episodes, so I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but overall I liked it. I liked this cast. I liked sort of doing the, you know, King reference spotting, like when they mentioned the kid who died by the tracks, I was like, okay, like check, I know that one. But yeah, the main quote accents are like, okay, don't, there's no need to attempt this. They didn't do it in The Shawshank Redemption and you shouldn't either.
Here's why they get away with that, because nobody outside Maine knows what a Maine accent sounds like.
Well, they know it's like Boston plus. I think people understand that. That like they know that it's like all the, you know, like all the sliders are pushed all the way to the right and it's maxed out. But that, like,
but there's like, a little bit of like Quebec in it too. Like it's a very right. weird. It's a weird yeah. thing. But so Dave, yeah, I mean, I liked it fine. I'm gonna keep watching it, I think. So
Dave Roth, you said you experienced all of the Stephen King movies of the Stephen King primacy era. Did the King spotting elements work for you, or was that tiresome?
They honestly took me out of it a little bit. Like, I didn't think that they were corny or anything. I mean, they were corny, but it wasn't the sort of thing where I was like sighing exasperated by like the Shawshank Redemption reference or something like that. Like, I just sort of felt like that wasn't for me. But it's weird. I mean, what you were saying too, in terms of this being mostly successful, but then also seemingly still confused after. I watched 4 episodes, seemingly still confused about what it wants to say or even what it's trying to scare us with. Like, there's something about it that situating it in that King universe is the only thing that really makes it coherent to me. That, like, at least you know that there is some element of like hauntedness and the supernatural in it, because if you came into it without any of those reference in your mind, it I think would be a very confusing tonal experience on top of everything else.
Yeah, I agree with that. Because it does seem like it's trying to make some points about like the carceral state, and then at the same time it's like, and the kid in the cage is the literal devil. So it's sort of like this is a big range of what you're trying to accomplish here. I mean, I agree with you that it feels sort of like the tweet of like nudging your date and saying that's Stan Lee when Stan Lee shows up. It's a little bit like that.
Yep.
And that's always what that finally is what soured me on Fargo, that and like the completely bizarre third season. But also even in Better Call Saul, when they like allude to things in the Breaking Bad-iverse that are coming up later, it's like, we all watched it. Like, we know, you know, this is not interesting to me. So I feel like they either need to do more with those or less.
Well, they have to do something that folds in on them. Like right now, like the only Stephen King connection is spookiness itself.
I think there is one character who did exist in some property that I had bailed on the books by the time this character showed up. So.
But maybe just like, I don't know anything about Stephen King books. So I haven't really, I know the gist of them, you know, the big ones that are turned into movies and stuff. But like, I would suspect that character you're talking about is that character in name only so far and not indeed. Because like, really what's happened so far in the show is they've set up, you know, this lawyer is sort of like picking at the surface of stuff that's going on in the town and people are getting nervous and things are happening. But all the Stephen King stuff is all ancient history in the show timeline, and nothing new Stephen King wise has happened, aka after King, you know, like I'm still waiting for like, don't open that door because it's the, oh my God, I opened the door and it was the Tommy knockers. I don't know what the Tommy knockers are, but the Tommy knockers are after me. Like, that hasn't happened yet. So like the Stephen King,
or it's just
stuff,
some kid named Tommy.
Yeah. Like, if you're coming into Castle Rock expecting to get a lot of Stephen King stuff, you're really just getting Easter eggs at this point in time. And I don't really know, certainly after 4 episodes, it hasn't happened yet that we're sort of like back in the thick of kinginess. That's not happened yet. You know, when you put a big billboard, you know, on your way to town, it says, you know, over 36 King attractions, you know, pull over right now, exit 38. And you pull over there and it's like nothing, right? And that's sort of like where Castle Rock is so far, and it might just be a slow burn, but it really just feels like, what can we stick on this to really like help marketing? Like, so far in 4 episodes, I'm a little skeptical about like how much Stephen King is actually in this, but it is keeping my attention as just a general low-level mystery, like what's happening in this spooky town.
It seems like it has the misfortune of being in like the less popular corner of the Stephen King universe. Like, it's not like Monster Fights, which is kind of, you know, that would be the thing that people would want with, like you were saying, like Cujo versus Christine, like test your might, you know, but I think, in this case, it's like, this is like the Dolores Claiborne-y, like just sort of like, which is an actual part of his canon, this kind of like shitty inland Maine, which is like the part of it that he personally inhabits and where he grew up, like Bangor and stuff. I was trying to figure out what town in Maine this was shot in. It was shot in Massachusetts, but that version of it that's like more kind of like fucked up, drug addicted, sad, post-industrial, like is not the, you know, but you were saying like nobody's pulling over for like, you know, this is the well down which Dolores Claiborne like possibly through her stepdad or whatever, that like that part of it is not the thing that puts asses in the seats. And yet like that is the part of it that this, you know, bravely or stupidly seems to right. show us into an habit.
Yeah, if you're coming this as a Stephen King fan and you're waiting for that content, are you going to find it and are you going to stick around long enough to get it if it is coming?
Well, but I think that's not necessarily a bad thing, because in my experience, like, and the marketing, I think, has been at pains to, like, give Stephen King and J.J. Abrams, like, equal footing in the press materials. But a lot of Stephen King adaptations are, like, actively bad, like, so bad that it's past camp and it's not even enjoyable. The ones that are good are very good, but they are often, like, Bachman books or, like, not... The things that worked so well in the books don't always translate, or not, they don't give it to a good translator. So if you, like me, were apprehensive that this was going to be another just kind of like Stephen King TM schlock fest starring Timothy Hutton as a totally not believable dissociative disorder person, it's like, okay, this is fine. Like, it doesn't have to be that kingy, because it's actually good and well acted and seems to understand the spirit of, you know, apprehension and whatnot. But if you're looking for a more traditional King experience, it is true that this may not be for you.
Yeah, but once you like excise the King from King, like, what is it? Like, I don't quite understand. Like, I don't find this spooky. Like, I want it to be spooky, but I don't really find it spooky. Like, there's a couple like, the creepy, you know, kid in jail is doing weird stuff to people's minds, but it's like really small part of what's going on. And like when you're left with everything else and your lead character, who is the lawyer, is just like always angry at everything. He's got like one tone. It's just to be angry. And you just can't change from that. It's like, oh, okay. Like I just like, I want the show to be something. I want the show to like go one way in the spectrum, even, you know, either king it up or, you know, go its own way, because like right now I'm just like left like, when's the king coming? When's the king coming? You know, and it's not coming.
It's
not
just
here.
Ominous lawyers.
There
all
is
the
no coronation.
Look, he was raised by Carrie. You'd be angry all the time, too.
That's true.
It's just, I mean, a little tiresome, that character.
Yeah, too. I mean, it's the it's the problem with any kind of show with a large ensemble cast, though, right? That like some storylines are going to be of interest to you and others aren't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then when they're servicing the ones that you find boring, like, it's boring. You know, for me, I was fascinated by the story of the kid and couldn't understand why no one was saying, like, wait, why are we keeping him in prison when there's no evidence that he committed any crime? Like, why didn't he? I mean, I get the public relations aspect and I understand they're evil prison contractors, but at the same time, it's like, so, no one called a social worker. Like, just Noel Fisher is responsible for getting him out of here. Oh, you know,
fucking Dale Stuckey. That's another thing that's really weird about this.
Yeah. But like, to me, there's not enough about the devil kid, but maybe they're just like backloading the season with him. I don't know. We watched all four of the screeners that we were provided as well. I was interested enough, but I don't know if I'm so interested that I will remember to check it out on Hulu every Wednesday when it comes out, because that's how Hulu does it. And it's really easy to forget that that's how
I have this thing with shows where when they're in the world building part of it at the start, like, I forgive a lot more. And but once that sort of fades away and I understand what the town is about, you know, it's a supernatural disaster waiting to happen. And like once they start to go and repeat with that sort of stuff, then it's really up to, you know, the actual show to keep me there. Like, that was the thing with Fargo. Like, I was very interested in Fargo and how they set up a world that was familiar yet separate. Like, that was pretty interesting how they did that in season one. But moving beyond that, you know, beyond that, it's really got to be like why season two worked for me is because it was like a big change. Suddenly it's a show about the mob. And or is that season two or season three?
Season two.
Yeah.
Season two.
That was like, that was interesting to me. But like, if Castle Rock just keeps on the same path, I can see myself moving away from it. So it's going to be interesting to see how and where, you know, they stake their claim on the show.
Would you say they need to hurry up and get to the Firestarter Works factory?
No. No, I will say this, though.
Nor should you.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point,
it's been a while,
in
guys,
your rambling, incoherent response, were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
All right. Any last thoughts on Castle Rock before we move on?
I guess I have one, which is that in a show like this, which I think we've agreed is like decent but confused in some ways, there's a certain like cheat code that you get when you cast really good actors, and the show's got a few really, really good actors in it. And I think it maybe tricked me into thinking it was more interesting than it was.
Yeah.
Because yeah. of those performers.
Yep. I would agree with that.
Like Holland, Scott Glenn. I mean, like Sissy Spacek has been playing some version of this part for a really long time and she's good at it. But she's like the Lady Robert Duvall now, like just kind of like a lady who's like sort of spookily glazed over eyes, like speaking into the middle distance. But like it works, you know. Yeah. It's like a Bartolo Colon sort of deal where like if this is all she's gonna do is throw like 82 miles an hour exactly on the corners, like she can basically do that until she decides she doesn't want to do it anymore.
It's true.
I feel like she's kind of being wasted on it, but that's a little baseball for all the listeners of your podcast that love baseball.
That's for you, Jeff Drake.
Only you.
Hello, listeners. It is Dave here to talk about HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that has taken the Cole Ariano household by storm. HelloFresh was designed from top to bottom to make dinner delicious, easy, affordable, and fun. Here is how it works, my friends. You pick from one of the three plans. They got the classic plan, they got the veggie plan, and they've got the family plan. And then, as if by magic, a box of fresh ingredients, carefully sourced by HelloFresh, arrives on your doorstep in a cooled box. Inside that box are your meal kits. Each kit comes with all the ingredients pre-measured and labeled, so you can't mess it up, either figuratively or literally. And because we're all busy people with jobs and fights on Twitter to win, HelloFresh gets you in and out of the kitchen with easy guided recipes that only take around 30 minutes, including lots of one-pot recipes for speedy cooking and minimal cleanup. Dinner just became easier, but it's also going to get a lot tastier. Get out of your culinary rut with a combination of HelloFresh's, Global Eats, and classic options. Maple glazed pork chops with sweet potato mash and garlicky green beans. Try the chickpea powered Mediterranean couscous next, and then maybe break out the meatloaf a la mom for the weekend. That's just a few of the possibilities at HelloFresh. The Cole Ariano household opted for the veggie plan, and we need to discuss my favorite meal. That is the za'atar crusted grilling cheese. And we're not talking about a grilled cheese sandwich, although grilled cheese sandwiches are tasty and fine. No, we're talking about this big slab of halloumi cheese, and it's dredged in these Middle Eastern spice mix called za'atar. And that's not the barbarian, that's thundar. We're talking za'atar. And the cheese is like charred on the outside, but it's like warm and melty on the inside. And then you serve it on this bed of pearl couscous. And you got some zucchini in there and grape tomatoes and sumac dusted red onions. It is amazing. It's like something you would pay like $15 for at a restaurant, but you're paying much less making yourself at home easy with HelloFresh. HelloFresh lets you make meals like that tonight without giving up your whole night. Get delicious, filling meals delivered right to your door every week for less than $10 per serving, and you get free shipping. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com/extra30. That's EXTRA30. And enter promo code EXTRA30. That's HelloFresh.com/extra30 with promo code EXTRA30 for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh. Our thanks to HelloFresh for sponsoring Extra Hot Crate. And by the way, if you're wondering, HelloFresh and Green Chef, our sister companies, two great meal kit delivery services under one umbrella.
ModCloth is the fun, friendly spot for style that's as expressive and unique as you are. Inspired daily by their amazing customers, it's ModCloth's mission to serve and celebrate their community, inspire individual style, and empower women to be the best version of themselves. That's why their signature line of apparel is offered in a full size inclusive range from extra extra small to 4X.
Sunny days are calling at ModCloth. You can get everything from travel-inspired prints to breezy sundresses. No cardigan required. And thank God, since your correspondents live in Caliente, Texas, and 120% humidity Brooklyn, but if you do need a cardi to go to the movies in, ModCloth has some very cute ones.
And fall is coming, and ModCloth's got you covered there, too, with denim, denim, and more denim. ModCloth's exclusive collaboration with Wrangler is all about the 70s nostalgia. Rock a pair of flares or a chambray top with fun embroidered details. Those styles and a wide variety of others all come in that complete range of sizes I mentioned. And so many of them come with pockets, a requirement for Buncey attire. The Wear It Well A-line skirt has an adorable print, fun detailing, dresses up or down, and my phone will not fall out of the very real practical size pockets. Buncey also enjoys putting a bird on it, and the Hum Sweet Home graphic tank top with hummingbirds on it went straight into the regular row the minute I got it.
As for me, I needed a polished yet fun look for the ATX Festival last month and found it with the appropriately named I Love Your Dress in Cobalt. It's light in the heat, easy to wear, and conforms to my signature color story of blue and things that go with blue. You can get your own ModCloth gear and a sweet discount. To get 15% off your purchase of $100 or more, go to modcloth.com, that's modcloth.com, and enter code EXTRA at checkout. Hurry, this offer expires on October 10th, 2018.
That's promo code EXTRA at modcloth.com for 15% off your purchase of $100 or more until October 10th.
Do it.
It is time to go around the dial. Our first stop, Tara.
Hello. Brian Rubenstein and I are not covering this season of Married at First Sight on Bride and Doom, partly because season seven started like 5 minutes after season six. But at the request of one of our fans, the producer of Married at First Sight, I did check out his other show, which is called 7 Year Switch. It's also on Lifetime. It airs right after Married at First Sight on Tuesdays. And the premise of this show is that they keep calling it switch therapy, which I don't think is a real thing that exists outside of this show. But the premise is that couples basically trade partners. It's like wife swap the show, not wife swapping the practice, I guess.
No.
Although I don't know if they can fuck. I assume that's allowed if they want to. But they move into Airbnbs in LA and then they spend time with people other than their partners to, I guess the theory is, highlight what is really at issue in their troubled marriages. My first problem with this, well, my first problem is that I don't think switch therapy is a thing. My second problem is that Dr. Jessica from Married at First Sight is also an expert on this show. And once you look at her and realize and listen to her and realize how much she is Ivanka Trump, it's impossible not to turn that off in your head. So I hate her now. But in addition to those two things, some of these couples have not even been together for 7 years. Some of them were like, we got married in 2012. Others are like, we've been married for 10 and a half years. It's called 7 Year Switch. If you haven't, like, are not meeting the minimum requirements of what your title says, get the fuck out of here. That said, some of these couples don't deserve love. There's a white guy with multiple kanji tattoos, and I do want him to get divorced because he should be alone forever. The other expert, in addition to Dr. Jessica, is Charles J. Orlando, a.k.a. Thick Paul Dinello. Watch the show and tell me I'm wrong. You can't. They've also assigned them all, personality profiles, like Charles, the free spirit, Kenya, the traditionalist. Some of them feel very gendered, like Bobby, the silent type, and Rosalind, the caretaker. One of the couples made Dr. Jessica put like little fabric booties over her heels when she came in, and one of the shots that made it into the edit shows it, which was very funny to me. But ultimately, okay, well, who am I kidding? I will definitely watch this because I need to see who's going to get divorced. Similar to Wife Swap, you're really just watching for like the moment when the original pairs get back together or the counterparts meet each other and like compare notes, like guy and woman and woman. But it's not as compelling as Married at First Sight, particularly since this season Married at First Sight cast an actual literal charged with a crime, Stalker, as one of its brides. And this week's episode, which has not aired yet as we record this, is going to involve her not being able to board the plane for her Married at First Sight honeymoon because she was being detained at customs because of this arrest. Can 7 year switch compete with this? Not really. But if you are still all fired up about other people's relationship problems after that airs, definitely stay and check out 7 year switch. As I said, they air back to back on Lifetime Tuesday nights. For my plug, Orange is the New Black season 6 premieres this week on Netflix, and I will be recapping it at Vulture. So starting on Friday, go to vulture.com and you can see my recaps of that.
How is it so far?
It's funny. It's good, but what mostly stands out to me after having watched all of Glow, because, you know, they have like creative people in common with both the shows. An hour of Orange is the New Black feels so long compared to Glow, which is like so snappy and lean and good and funny. Like Orange is the New Black is obviously a very different kind of show, but it just feels so flabby by comparison. But interesting stuff is happening. It's like the aftermath from the seize of the prison, which took up all of season 5 pretty much. And so there's interesting stuff going on with that and how they're isolating characters from each other to try to basically frame them, or again, much like Castle Rock, deal with the public relations nightmare of what has happened. So, you know, if you like the show, you will like this season. If you don't care, this is not the season to tune in for, I would say.
All right, Dave, what do you have?
Most of the television that I wind up watching is stuff that I watch in concert with my wife. I mean, in terms of the do you want me to say that in a Borat voice? Or do you okay if I just do it? You're okay if I just do it normal?
Whatever
stuff
you
that
feel.
That I watch with my wife. And I tier that in terms of, because she is a more ardent consumer of television than I am. And so there's shows that I will be in the room while she's watching, but I'll be booping around on my computer or whatever. There's ones I will actively watch. And then there's ones that I won't be in the room at all for, which is mostly the Shondaland family of brands. and the show that we just finished watching and that I enjoy the most is one that went from that bottom tier all the way to me actively watching it, which is Bosch on Amazon.
Finally, someone else watches that show.
Hello. It feels weird. Yeah, well, I'm glad to know you. I haven't talked about it very much with other people either. It's extremely exciting for me. Bosch is real. It's a real show that you can watch.
It is.
It's not just a meme, not just a Titus Welliver meme. It is a popular Titus Welliver meme online, but it is it's also a real thing that I think is quite good. And it went from, it's like something that she started watching on an airplane, like coming back from a work trip or something like that. So absolutely getting in like the bottom tier of the sub basement of televisual entertainment. And then fucking Bosch, you know, he worked his way up, stayed plugging, and it went from me being a thing that like I would make up silly songs involving the name Bosch when she would be watching it to torment her. Like I can't sing it very well, but if you are a good singer, Billy Ocean's Caribbean Queen, you can sing Amazon's Bosch to the same tune as that, and it sounds fine. Yeah. The one that
My husband went with Meet the Bosch. Come on out and greet the Bosch. Bring the kitties.
I like it a lot.
Shoot your wife. Yeah.
Guaranteed you're doing 25 to life. The,
yes, there
the
it
general,
is.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of practice on this. But it has this goofy saxophone theme song. Like, it shouldn't work. And yet, like, it is really, I think, location-wise, it gets a lot of stuff right that, I mean, it's unfair to compare it to Castle Rock because it's set in an actual existing American city as opposed to in, like, Stephen King's expanded mind palace. But the
gym.
Yeah, like the dusty wings of it. But it feels and seems very native to Los Angeles in a way that I think very few shows do at this point. But like to Los Angeles or to any place else, like there's an attention to geographic detail and to locations that, as somebody who's like, I went to school out there, we go back and visit. Like, I like Los Angeles, but I've never, you know, lived there for longer than a few months at a time. But it is. It's not like the, you know, the seamy Los Angeles demi-monde or whatever. Like, it's shot in like bright daylight in like downtown Los Angeles in the San Gabriel Valley a lot in season 4. Neither one of which are will be just, you know, confused for glamorous locations, but it really nails it. And it works around the fact that that Welliver himself, who's a, you know, completely competent performer as Detective Harry Bosch, like, is a cipher and never talks and his, you know, face hardly moves. The other actors in it carry the weight, and the just in general, like, I haven't enjoyed a procedural at a level above the, like, it just, like, being a thing that's on during the weekend when you're doing other stuff. Like, this is one that I actually enjoyed paying attention to, and I think I got something out of.
Nice.
Sarah, what do you also dig it? Like, you are the other Bosch head?
Yeah, to the point where, like, I have a little Google alert to tell me when it's, you know, when it's coming back or if it gets renewed. Like, I didn't read the books, and I'm tempted to get into those just to sort of tide me over. But I agree with you that, you know, blah, blah, the city is a character, but it is. The way they shoot it in that sort of, like, golden West Coast noir way is really cool. I like the whole cast. Dr. Tony Pavone is his lieutenant. Jamie Hector as his partner. I wish he had more to do and not, like, getting into it with his wife about, you know, his being a cop, which is absolutely my least favorite thing on TV. I like
that's also his whole arc this season too, which is lame. Is like a series of, it's like just watching two people play handball with each other.
Yeah,
it's frustrating.
It's just not that it's like, well, he got shot, and if he still wants to go back to work, you know, Mrs. Jamie Hector, you lost. Like, just leave. Then do we have
every
to have
time
this
the phone
conversation?
Rings or there's a knock at the door? I have to wonder, is it somebody telling me that you are dead?
Yeah. Wow, where'd you get that clip? That was amazing. Yeah, no. That was
no,
so fast.
It's Sarah D. Bunting telling you to shut the fuck up because the fact that being a cop's wife sucks is the worst kept secret in the world. Besides the fact that babies cry. Give me a fucking break. But yeah, I really like the show. It doesn't try to be anything it isn't. Like, it's, I mean, it's not, you know, maybe prestige TV, but it doesn't have to be, and it doesn't need to be. It does exactly what it sets out to do. I always enjoy it and binge watch the whole season in like 2 days, and then I'm like drumming my fingers waiting for another season. It's good.
You know, yeah, I've said it before, and I really want it to start taking off. We should start calling these type of shows, as you say, not quite prestige. We start calling them the turn shows. Because it's what becomes before the prestige.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Nice little shorthand.
I see it. No, I get it.
Okay.
I get it.
All right.
Nice.
And what do you got to pitch?
To plug? Oh, gosh. Just my dumb blogs and podcasts. I don't know. I mean, I'm not doing anything to do with
well
television.
Done. Good pitch.
Yeah, thanks. They're terrible, too. Wow. People hate them.
You're an editor at Deadspin.com.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I always forget that. Yes, I'm an editor at Deadspin.com. I do a podcast there called The Deadcast with Drew McGarry. And I do a podcast, as you mentioned, with Jeb about Hallmark movies, which is now free. That is no longer a Patreon-only feature. So that'll be nice. I've watched the wrong movie for this week's podcast. I watched a Candace Cameron movie for no reason. I've never been so owned in my entire life.
So one of you is talking about one movie and the other one's talking about the other, and that's the episode?
No, I checked with, no, it was, we have a friend who's on it with us, and she sent in her clips, and I was like, none of these things involve Tom Skerritt at all. What movie were you? And yeah, just a terrible feeling. So I have to, yeah, I still have to watch The Mistletoe Inn with Alicia Witt. God. Have to get to at some point in the next couple days.
Will
as do we all, I think. As do we all. Sarah D. Bunting.
Okay, well, I'm glad that someone led with sort of a Buncey show, because I'm back with another show that basically only I watch. It is the third season of Last Chance U. It's on Netflix, and it's about the junior college football program. It used to be at this school in Eastern Mississippi. They have since moved to Independence, Kansas. But it's the same basic premise, which is you're following this like football team, many of them former Division I recruits who didn't have the grades or got bounced for, quote, personal issues or whatever. And this is their last chance to get into a Division I four-year school. And then from there, to the NFL, which by the time some of these kids pull it together and do that, even in 2 years, who knows what the NFL is even going to be. It's right. There's going to be like, I don't know, it's going to be like scooter hockey and pillow polo and all the crappy versions of actual sports that we played at girls' school. So we'll see. But the one of the stars of the first two seasons was that Brittany Wagner, who was there, was the academic advisor for the students, and her sort of like stressed out but very like wonderful relationship that she had with all of these guys. And the new Brittany Wagner is LaTanya Pinkard, and she announces in her first 2 seconds on screen that she doesn't give tests in class because if she doesn't give tests, nobody can cheat on them. And then she says in a talking head that I can see the train wreck coming and I am the train, so move. She also teaches class in 5-inch white patent leather heels. So sure. My people, mm-hmm. obviously. And it's if you decide to watch this, it's going to drive you nuts who Jason Brown, the head coach, sounds like. It's Matthew McConaughey. Let me just save you a whole lot of like, it's only listening to the TV while contorting yourself and being like, who does he remind me of? Because he could look less, I guess, like McConaughey if he were Asian. But yeah, it's going to bug you. You're welcome. I saved you the trouble. But it's still the same. It's still the same issues of like race and class and small town America and the shitty underclass that NCAA athletics create. And then like they create this problem that they then purport to solve. And it's really well edited and put together. I've always really liked this show. Moving locales has not changed its appeal at all. And I definitely recommend it. The whole third season is on Netflix now, and there's a like 1 hour follow-up special with some of the key figures from the Eastern Mississippi School. So that's pretty cool also. For my plug, The Blotter Presents is back in action. Starting next week, I will have guests again. This time out, I've got a sort of long reading / listening list for the Summer of Scam, so-called, by Vulture.
Nice.
A lot of scam artists, identity thieves, lots of links to reading that you can do when you're not listening and driving in the car. That is all available at the-blotter.com or subscribe to The Blotter Presents on your podcast app. And yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Do you know me? It's frightening how many novels of suspense I've written. Still, when I'm not recognized, it just kills me. So instead of saying I wrote Carrie, I carry the American Express card. Without it, isn't life a little scary?
To apply for the card, look for an application and take one.
The American Express card. Don't be home without it.
Music means it is time for the canon. Everybody, I don't want to give it away, but you guys are in for a treat. What a weird, 1 hour of television to be talking about in the canon. Take it away, Dave Roth.
So my original choice for this was an actual very good hour of television that changed the way that I thought about the medium. And then I realized almost too late that what I actually wanted to talk about was the strangest and most ridiculous episode of Law and Order SVU that I've ever seen, and that I can't imagine that there's anything in the whatever 35 seasons of the show that could possibly measure up to it. It's season 10, episode 7, Wildlife. It is, I believe, Big Boy from Outkast's debut as an actor. And I don't want to get too far ahead, but his character is eaten by a hyena. Bones and all, he ate the bones. And that's not the strangest thing that happens in the episode.
No, nope.
I'll walk y'all through it. This is an episode that has it's dearly beloved in my community of friends. We watched it on New Year's Eve a few years ago. We got together at a party for, and it was nice. We were just sort of getting together and chanting along with it. Not really chanting along with it, but definitely eagerly anticipating the hyena scene. I guess we'll say that. So. At the time that it was made, this was the most expensive episode of SVU that ever existed. It deals with animal smuggling. Animals, in this case, are our special victims. Although we begin, as we would ordinarily begin in an SVU episode, well, we begin with Stabler, Christopher Maloney, having been shot and being near death. And then we go back 1 week earlier. So again, there's like, I think of this as it's a thing that all cop shows kind of have as an arrow in their quiver, that they could have one of their characters get shot. I always assumed, just as homicide is my basic, you know, sort of template for how this stuff is supposed to work, that you don't do it unless you really have a good reason for it, because it's a traumatic thing to do to your character and to do to your audience. That is not the approach that Law & Order SVU took here. Stabler getting shot is, again, this is also an episode where a hyena eats a guy. There's a lot of incident. He's near death. We go back a week earlier and find a model dead, covered in saliva and bitten to death in a park. While they're going over the body, they don't know that she'd been bitten to death yet, but Benson discovers a dead bird in her bag, and you can hear, this will give you a sense of the tenor of the dialogue early in the episode. It changes abruptly as we go further, but this is worth listening to.
Look at this. It's a hell of a place to keep a pet.
The perp whacked the parakeet too.
Maybe some kind of mob warning. Dead bird can't sing.
Just fucking Law and Order Mad Libs. Really good stuff. like satisfying at a deep level. And it goes on from there. Not all of it is that sort of like hard-boiled dialogue with traumatic brain injury vibe, but there is
a lot of
whipsaws tonally. Yes, there's a great deal of it, but it is so incident-packed that, all right, so what you begin with the bird. It turns out that the bird was being smuggled by the model, and that the model was killed by a tiger, was eaten to death by this tiger. The initial suspect is they quickly discover that there is, by going back over and doing some shoe leather police work, Ice-T and Maloney discover that this woman was brought into the sort of club demimonde by the thought wrangler for a club called Supple. And we get a sense here, too, of this is another episode where everybody in it is completely hideous and gnarled and deserving of death by tiger. Only some of them get it. But you can hear what this is. Oscar takes the cops to the late Natalie, the tiger bitten model's place, and we meet her hideous roommate.
Right, when's the last time Natalie came and went?
I don't know, a couple days ago. Hey, if you see her, tell her I want that $50 she owes me.
You'll be waiting on that a while. She's dead.
So does that mean that I can have her clothes? Sweet.
You two must have been close.
Bosom buddies.
Where else except in the Law & Order universe do people expect police officers to be message couriers to other people?
It really is amazing too. Like, if you find her, like, I don't know, like, can I have her phone? Do you have it? Do you have any of her personal effects? It is really whatever. So a vision that is, again, both extremely dark and down on humanity, and yet also exists in a universe entirely parallel to our own. They continue. This is a slightly more high-techy sort of Law & Order experience. They track her phone using a proprietary Law & Order technology. You don't see a lot of computers on this show. One of the reasons why is when you see the computers on the show, you kind of know that that's not a strong suit. One thing that I noticed from it that I especially enjoyed is when they do finally track down the late Natalie's phone at a place called the Pounding Ezra Cafe,
yeah,
which is really, I don't even know what that would be a euphemism for, but it sounds risky, I guess. The computer that they use displays the data in the signature Law & Order font on the screen, which is wonderful. Like, everything except for the donk donk sound when the information is returned is there. They get in touch with Natalie's sister and discover that she had been hanging out with a rapper who, it turns out, owns a tiger. Her sister, played by Caitlin Fitzgerald, who would also, like many other people in this cast, would go on to do bigger things, is convinced that this was always coming once she got into the life.
That's why I hung up on you when you called. I thought it was this jerk Gotts calling.
Who?
Gotts Money, the hip-hop artist.
Artist? Try chump. What was she doing with that loser?
This sets up one of the most entertaining tensions in the episode, which is Ice-T, himself a legendary rapper from the West Coast, just constantly shitting on Big Boy, a legendary rapper from Atlanta, and the two of them... And Big Boy is Gott's money. Let me do that again. Big Boy is Gott's money. And we finally run into him at the studio. He is like, but again, like we were saying earlier, good performers are sort of a cheat code for things like this. This is one of the more stilted episodes of one of the most stilted shows that's ever existed. And it really does seem like Big Boy's improvising his entire part. There's a great moment where when he's dealing with Ice-T and Ice-T is being rude to him, where he just says, "What's up, pimp?" Which is the only time that "What's up, pimp?" is ever going to be said in a Law and Order episode. And it clearly is not something that was in the dialogue. In this case, they go to the studio. They find Big Boy kicking some hilariously terrible raps that were clearly written in the script. And then admits that he knew Natalie and has a... This clip here will show you a little bit about what his character is like, how the cops deal with him, and then also, again, the universe in which this whole thing is happening.
Now, how about Natalie Blears? You got her?
I got a girl for every day of the week, and that seems to be my Freaky Friday, bitch. Last night was Friday, so that sucks for you. But I'm enough for your 9 capper in the head. I ain't kill nobody, and I ain't got no 9. And besides that, that girl done seen more nuts than a can of planters, so...
That's right.
I had to kick that crazy bitch to the curb. It was too much drama for a hit it and quit it, brother such as myself.
Too much drama for you.
Stable.
And you're living out a movie right here with all your Pacino posters and this bling.
At least I got it.
All day.
And I got something for you, too. One of my ringtones, half price.
Still too much money.
Yeah. So I obviously seasoned. So anyway, we're like 5 minutes into the episode now, but it will speed up. I just wanted to add as an aside, I think you could do like a solid hour-long clip of Law and Order characters being dismissive about rap from like Jerry Orbach to the present day. And then this one, I mean, it's always going to be attention because of, you know, Ice-T's past career and his instant recognizability as Ice-T. But this episode, I wouldn't say so much plays with it so much as it just gives him an opportunity to be really grouchy about rap in a way that shows his cop bona fides. It later is revealed that Gott's money is, in fact, all talk and living out a movie. It wasn't his tiger that ate Natalie. They test it. The tiger that lives in his apartment. Wrong saliva, so it's a different tiger. But he does admit that he fell in with some animal smugglers. That's where he got the tiger. It seems like Natalie was working for them. She was smuggling that bird. Gott's gets Maloney undercover in with... the Bushido, who's the animal smuggler, is part Russian, part Italian, we're told, who not only killed Natalie and had her smuggling that bird, but is running a ring in which models smuggle exotic animals into and out of the country by means of strapping them to themselves, hiding them in different things. It's clearly not realistic, and yet the show pauses for a lot of kind of like chunky exposition about how animals are actually the third most trafficked thing on Earth. This is a terrible scourge and something needs to be done about it. That little bit of like chunky advocacy later won the show an award for its from animal rights groups that were like, thank you for finally talking about people smuggling turtle eggs on models' torsos. In this case, anyway, so Gotts gets Maloney in with the smugglers, but the smugglers are skeptical of Gotts. And that is sadly the last we hear of him, because as I mentioned earlier, and hopefully didn't give away too much, the smugglers release some hyenas on him and they eat him.
Hyenas are his calling card?
And his murder weapon. Their jaws are strong enough to pulverize bone. They can eat and digest almost anything. Except hair and metal.
You telling me that thing killed Gotts?
Check out the hyena vomit. He have a lot of bling.
So long, Gotts.
Yeah, you gotta check out the hyena vomit.
Fight a nickel.
Yeah, seriously. It's like I'm way ahead of you. I've had my eyes on that thing from the moment I walked in the room. Anyway, so we're dealing with some bad guys. Maloney continues to work his way under. We find out more about their operation as he sits down with Bushido undercover as a customs agent named Mike, who who enjoy some tiger meat. It seems like Bushido, to get rid of some loose ends, assassinated the tiger that he used to commit the murder. I don't know if is that the term you'd use for killing a tiger that you used as a murder weapon? You would assassinate it?
Yo, boss, what happens if the tiger talks?
Yes, you say, no loose ends. So instead of releasing that, he had told the tiger that he was going to be allowed to re-enter society, but then presumably murdered it in the cutscene.
Well, you know, a tiger can't change its stripes, so.
Oh, jeez. It's funny, though, because I chose the episode, so it's the sort of thing where all I can do is wear that. I have to accept that you said that and do a fucking thing about it. Yeah. So we learned a little bit while Mike, Customs Mike, is undercover about how Bushido gets things into the country. And this, again, it's irradiated turtle eggs. And then we learned a little bit more after that about what his big plans is for his next score.
What the hell is that?
Radiated turtle eggs. Flew them fresh from Madagascar tonight. Each one is worth $5,000.
Liana's a human incubator.
Is that how you do it? You get a pretty girl to get on the plane?
Yeah. Everybody wondering how she looks naked. Not if she's smuggling turtle eggs.
So true. You really do hear it more and more. At this point, Bushido lets Mike in on his next score, which is going to be bringing in a white-crested gibbon, the rarest monkey in the world, only 17 left alive. It's coming in from Laos. It's going to be worth $1 million, and he's selling it to a creep who wants to kill the monkey and use its breastbone to make the most expensive chopsticks ever known to man. That's all real. That is an actual plot device in this thing. So Stabler at this point is deep undercover as Mike, and with these smugglers, this is he's doing a lot of terrible police work, like extremely risky, going off half cocked, even by Stabler standards. Like, it's not the sort of thing where he's like threatening to punch a perp who's like handcuffed. He's definitely like inviting an animal smuggling tiger murderer into his home and agreeing to wear a tracking device for them. Whatever this is, he at some point, like Benson, Mariska Hargitay shows up. This is apparently a legendary fan service moment for people that are into shipping these two characters.
Yep.
As somebody that's never had those thoughts, because no show has a squickier or more perverse approach to sex than this one. The idea that you could be horny watching an SVU episode is honestly inspiring to me. Like, I feel like horniness at this point is the one thing that we know can change the world. Like, we have the last election to show for it. I believe that, you know, I think everybody could talk about how being horny has changed their lives in some way or another. People that want these two characters to fuck almost get what they want. At the very least, they get them. They get Benson pretending to be a prostitute in order to get Mike out of a tight spot. But it is, again, characteristically perverse, as with everything else in this episode.
Maybe Gibbon's too expensive to risk over sedating, so I gotta either have it on his person or in his carry-on.
So we look for something squirmy.
Or a guy in a big hat. Bushido told me that's how they brought in their last baby Gibbon.
Elliot, on the left. Check out the guy with the magic basketball.
Liv. Guy in the green jumpsuit, Kobe from Jakarta. Monkey's in the basketball.
Guys, have you ever seen Midnight Run? I'm ready at the end of Midnight Run when they're in the airport and he's the wire has gone dead and he just has to scream, Serrano's got the discs! Serrano's got the discs! I just really wanted that to be that. The monkey's in the basketball! The monkey's in the basketball!
It's like a Paul Simon lyric. It's just kind of gnomic, nonsensical, evocative in its way. So I probably fucked up there in terms of not running through some of the things that happened between Bushido shooting Mike / Maloney and then him recovering miraculously from these two gunshots that nearly kill him in a few hours to be at the sting at the airport where they discover that the monkey's in the basketball.
I think you glossed over it exactly how the show glossed over it. I think it was a art imitating life.
So the thing I would like to, so that bit that you just heard is the, this is the dramatic action of the last part of the show and the part that I believe gives it its one truly iconic and legendary image. But I would like to just point out that before any of this happens, when Maloney is shot, there are 8 minutes left in the episode. It's like the 32 minute, 51 second mark. So at that point, when we think that our main character is possibly dead or dying, we still have to get the monkey out of the basketball at the airport. We still have to arrest Bushido. And it is later revealed that Reg Cathy is deep cover working for Fish and Game or something like that.
Yep.
On a ring of smugglers. But the important thing, I guess, is the monkey in the basketball bit is paying off the smuggling part in, I think, maybe my favorite moment that has ever appeared on the show. Before we get to the monkey being rescued, which, spoiler, the monkey is rescued from the basketball, there is one last clip, which is Bushido preparing to make his sale of the basketball monkey to the very evil Mr. Kwan. I think this is worth listening to as well.
Mr. Kwan, you have something for us.
Gentlemen, $1 million.
Now on one of only 17 gibbons left in the world.
Soon to be 16.
Police! Dumbbells! Get on the ground! Ah!
Kwan, you fucking sicko, man.
$1 million.
No, it's bad Dude. Enough to be like, soon to be 16, I'm gonna kill this fucking thing. It's just like, I mean, obviously, you know, he's a bad guy because he wants to kill a monkey to turn it into chopsticks. But I think, again, they're perhaps a bit heavy handed. Unfortunately for him, Kwan does not get his wish. The monkey is released from the basketball, which in earlier scenes is seen as like a regular size basketball rolling around seemingly of its own volition due to the monkey within. It is replaced during the rescue scene when they yell the monkey's in the basketball. Kwan throws the monkey at Kragen. As an attempt to distract him, like the way that when someone's being chased in a cop movie, they'll turn over a garbage can because there's no way that Tom Cruise can jump over it. And in this case, so he throws the basketball at Craig, and we see Dan Florek catching it. The basketball is now suddenly four times larger. He opens a hatch in its top and an actual gibbon comes out and gives him just a super tender hug that he returns very tenderly. There's some shit in there about, you know, after that, yeah, the right guys are arrested. Stabler learns a valuable lesson about telling his wife when he's going undercover to try to disrupt an animal smuggling ring. And I think, and then executive producer Dick Wolf.
Yep.
Mostly I chose this because of the monkey hugging Dan Florek, which is one of my favorite images that I've ever encountered in any filmed medium. But the real reason that I think it would make a suitable canon selection is the fact that it gets it's like six seasons of crazy SVU shit in one episode, and I don't think I've ever seen anything more ludicrously condensed than this.
Well, Sarah, as our expert on SVU, you should go first.
Okay, thank you for this outstanding presentation, Other David. This is absolutely peak SVU. Stabler is still there. Munch, although I think he's not even seen in this episode, is still there. It's like still the basically the core lineup. The monkeys in the basketball line, the check out the hyena vomit line, the things that Tamara Tooney is obliged to like just disgorge these nunchuck balls of clunky exposition about animal smuggling, tiger saliva, the bacteria present in like hyena poo. It's just like, girl, like no wonder she was like, you know what? I don't need to be in the credits. Bye.
In Latin too, in a bunch of cases, like just get on with it. Like this is not impressing anyone.
Yeah. There's also Carlos Madonna's first baby daddy Leon as that skis ball Oscar who's doing the model soliciting. There's the tracking visuals for, I don't even know what they would call this program, like Fat Bat or Face Base or like another universe. I mean, look, this is not the most craze balls SVU of all time. That, of course, is the Vixie Platinum episode. Eventually, we'll get to that one. But this one is like extremely typical SVU and also extremely typical of this era where it's like bonkers, but the self-seriousness is not yet bogging down the pacing and making Olivia completely off-putting and teary, and with the, you know, constant references to going home to hug her boy. Like, it's yes. It's just bonkers and campy, and not bonkers, campy, smug, and boring, which is where we are currently in season 81. I could do without the, like we were just talking about, like, cop's wife has had it. Like, really? Walking around your living room with baby number 5? Now you've had it? Okay, cool. Shut up, Kathy, and all the other stablers. But
get her. Drag her ass, Sarah.
Oh, she's already been gotten. But she, like, that's also very typical of the show. It's not as bad as, like, in season 1 when there would be, like, table talk time with Maureen and, you know, the issues of the day.
Oh, God, yes.
But you know, they pay at least me back by showing Stabler in his boxer briefs, snuggling with his teething child, you know, despite 2 bullet wounds that would probably make it pretty hard to lift up a yelling kid in the middle of the night, but realism, not for me. This was really fun to rewatch. And even if there was nothing else fun in the episode except Florek Gibbon snuggling, I'd watch that spinoff. And this presentation was hilarious. I laughed many times. Tara.
I can't believe this is our first SVU presentation, and yet I'm so
either.
Glad it's this, because
I couldn't believe it was either. I kept scrolling through the canon looking for stuff, and there was like all my favorite episodes of all my favorite shows are in there. And then somehow not the monkey hugging Dan Florek.
I know. It's an oversight that I, no spoilers, feel is probably going to be corrected after this. I mean, this was delightful.
The floodgates of monkeys have opened.
The basketball is open.
Yes. Excuse me.
Extra points to you for Thought Wrangler as the descriptor for Oscar. Brilliant.
Oh, God.
So right about the bad police work. Not only did Stabler not tell his wife he was going undercover, the first that Kragen hears about it is when Olivia has to be like, he's in trouble. Like, what the fuck are you idiots doing this time? Like, they're always doing something.
True.
Sarah, you're so right about Benson. This was also, not for nothing, her best styled season in terms of fashion and hair, which is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Including her bra, which we do get to see in this episode when she's pretending to be a prostitute who calls Stabler daddy.
Oh, that was a clip that I had. Like, it's in my notes that there's like a moment where she's like, are you ready for me, daddy? And I was like, I don't.
Yes.
Like, why would I ask someone to clip that? I would never. I don't even know, Dave, but that's a terrible thing to do to somebody.
Thank you.
Get out.
No problem, dude. Absolutely. I would do it for anyone. But
yeah. Kathy, always a pill for the reasons that Sarah just said. I would also note, whether this episode deserved an award from an animal rights organization is not for me to say, but I will say the details of the fucked up shit that smugglers, which I assume at least some of this is true, do to animals, like putting slits in the bird's eyes so they don't know when it's day or night to sing. I am opposed to capital punishment, except in the case of anyone who abuses animals, because they should be crushed by an anvil out of a Roadrunner cartoon. That is the only fitting punishment for them.
Concur.
Thank you. Excellent job, Dave. Cool.
Okay. What I like about this episode is it answers the question, what if Law and Order, but the freshman? The Matthew Bogdan, which is basically what this is. You know, it's a bunch of real weirdos getting really exotic animals so they can make other products out of them. It is so weird to me that this is an episode of Law and Order SVU. And if I have one problem with this episode, is that nobody gets raped. So all I'm saying is, if you're going to have a Law and Order SVU,
Jesus Christ,
hang on, and it's all about. So I'm just saying, maybe the monkey should have got raped.
You're saying this could have just as easily been a Law & Order Prime episode because it still existed
totally.
At the time.
Yes.
Yeah. Primate, I think you meant to say.
Boy.
A little birdie told me that would be a good joke. What?
I'll let us up. And it's all my fault. That's what makes it feel worse.
What struck me about this episode is how very white and old the writing room must be for this series. Like, Gott's money, like that is like you know, with the Z and everything. It's and then how pleased they were with that choice and how many times they used it. SVU, from, you know, the limited episodes I saw, you know, there are some things they like to touch on a lot. They really like to bring up how many times you're going to get your ass pounded in prison for things. And there's a whole like game that Ice-T and Stabler play with Gott's money in order to like squeeze him for information. And I clipped it. And all I can think about every time I listen to like this clip or anything with Gott's money is I could just see like there's six like 48 to 52 year old white dudes all around this room writing this stuff and like being very pleased with themselves.
Money, you know how to play getting the dice?
Nope.
Here's how it goes. Your celly rolls the dice. 9. That's how many days you get to play as girlfriend. Look, dude, we gots enough to lock you away right now. You'll be inside 6 months before you ever see trial. That's a lot of dice rolling.
Well, look at that. I gots an 11.
Okay.
Two gots.
Hey, guys, please stop talking about me getting butt fucked.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that is like accurate is him saying he's from Westchester. Like, yep, that's the writer's room. There you go.
Yeah. You know, we do get exposition Ice-T, which is always fun. Not a lot, but, you know, a little bit at the start. Although every time Ice-T talks, I just like my mind instantly just goes to the John Mulaney skit. And I can't, like, it takes me a little while to get back into the show every time. The one thing that you didn't clip, besides the dice thing, that I really thought merited a listen was the second time that Mike Stabler, as the custom guards, Mike, which for some reason, every time he said that, cracks me up. The character's name is just he's Mike. I don't know why I find that funny. But he goes back after the whole tiger thing and this exchange with the big animal baddie.
What happened to the tiger?
Tasty mother, isn't he?
Ah. Never enjoyed tiger meat before.
Mark, you would not believe what gets people off.
There's a moment where Mike is eating the tiger meat when he, you know, just moments after he discovers it, where he's channeling the facial expressions of Gene, his character from... is it Gene from
Yes.
Wet Hot American Summer.
Yeah, I thought that was where you were going.
And also Tom Hanks eating caviar and big, but he's about to be like,
yeah, it is great. Yeah, this episode is just crazy. It is so weird to think of it that, you know, it got from concept to paper to script reading and actually got on the air. It is so weird and goofy and just like all over the place. And like the moment you clipped with the first appearance of the basketball in the airport, of course, being an audio podcast, we can't really sell you how goofy the self-moving basketball is. It's sort of like, remember when that first generation of like self-moving toys with the ball and the raccoon tail came out?
Yep.
Or like, mm-hmm. The, you know, it was in a fake potato chip bag and it moved around. Like that's what it looks like in the airport, yet nobody notices. And the guy like just nonchalantly puts his foot on it to stabilize it, but then like takes his foot off of it again like 3 seconds later. Like, dude, you've got like, you know, a life sentence waiting to happen if you get caught in the airport. Like, mind your monkey, man. Like
also that classic move of when you have a basketball and you just put your foot on it.
Yeah.
Like, this is the one thing you can't do with a basketball. You can put it under your arm. You could dribble it, although that would be bad. The monkey would be upset. But nobody treats it. He treats it like a soccer ball.
Yeah.
It's just really took me out of the moment, because until then I was really right there.
Also, who flies with a fucking basketball? Like, buy a basketball when you get there. It's a basketball.
Yeah. What a weird bonkers episode. Like, obviously this isn't good TV, but it is like entertaining TV. And, you know, the canon is many things. We've certainly had our share of non-prestige, even non-turn shows that got into the canon. I think like Sarah might have actually done the first one when we did our first 90210 episode, which is terrible, but still very entertaining. And that's where this is. But in addition to terrible and entertaining, it is also like a great poster subject for bonkers TV. And Sarah is absolutely right that the reason it works as bonkers TV is because it's not bogged down in its own self-importance. And that counts for a lot. So I don't know if I could handle it if it was also trying to teach me life lessons. So yeah, an enjoyable hour of television, a weird hour of television, possibly the only hour of television with a hyena vomit. You know, let's check into that, but I'm pretty sure probably it. Yeah, what a weird ride. Thank you for bringing it to me. I'd never seen this before. Tara, you were saying that the monkey thing they got in one take, the monkey hug?
Maybe two. I can't remember. Yeah. I didn't actually go back and reread that Pacific Standard story, but I'll link it in the show notes.
Okay. So I did. The monkey got it right both times, but he pooped on Florek the first time, so they had to do a second one.
That's perfect. That's real. That is absolutely perfect. All right. Monkey. Let's put this little gem of a episode to the vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, big yes.
Tara Arrieta.
Monkey in a basketball, the end. Yes, of course.
Yeah, I'm going to say yes, too. The only thing would have been better if that monkey got raped. So that would have been a true SCP episode.
Really? Can't believe that's going to stay in. Okay.
That means Law & Order Special Victims Unit Season 10, Episode 7, Wildlife. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for winner and loser of the week. Who has our winner?
Me. The winner is Supergirl. Next season, she will be playing the character Dream Girl on the show on the CW and will thus make history as the first transgender superhero, which is awesome. Great year for trans visibility and more to come, I would hope. And that's especially amazing for them to do in a show for kids. So good job, Supergirl, and good job, CW.
Yeah. Sarah, who is our loser of the week?
Brady Bunch fans hoping to visit the famous exterior of the house may be out of luck. The house is for sale for the first time since, like, I've been alive. I think it was sold in 1973. And the price is high enough that they think developers are probably going to buy it, which means it could be torn down. I have a feeling that will not happen, but if there's some way to, like, make a little condo out of it, and I don't know, there's ways to make money off that property without tearing the house down. So I hope that doesn't happen. But apparently it's the second most photographed house in the world. Besides the White House.
It's like $1.9 million or something, right?
Yeah. Like, what's with the Brooklyn prices? Well, take it easy.
Isn't it like in Sherman Oaks or something like that?
Yeah.
Studio City.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, right.
Wow. That's a lot of money even for, you know, that.
The Brady House. And there's not a toilet in it, as we all saw. Just kidding.
Speaking about things without toilets in them, do you know what time it is?
Game time.
It's game time. I don't actually want the monkey to get raped. I was just saying, I just think that's an essential part.
I understood your point. You're saying it shouldn't have been an SVU if there wasn't a rape in it. It should have been regular Law and Order.
What's a specialer victim than a little monkey?
All right. Yeah.
Okay, moving on. This is the fourth game time of the season. Remember, last week was non-regulation play. So the season scores are still Tara with 3, Sarah with 0, and Value Guests also with 0. Today we are playing A Rose by Any Other Name from Rebecca, who earns herself an extra credit, redeemable for an extra hot great mini topic of her choosing sometime in the future. She writes, "Sure, we welcome beloved TV characters into our home every day, but how well do we really know them? Is the name they go by actually their name, or is it an alias or nickname? Are our characters assuming an identity for nefarious reasons, or a silly one? Sometimes we can even watch a show for years and not realize that we never knew our character's real name. In this game, we will give you the name of a character from a show. It might be their better-known name, or it might be their lesser-known one. And either could be their real name. For 2 points, you give us the other name and the show they are from. If you don't recognize it, I will give you a hint, which is going to be the show, and you guess the character for 1 point. Make sense? So yes, I'm going to give you one name. You're going to give me the other that they're known by.
And
if you don't
know
it, I'll give you the show as a hint.
Got it.
Okay. We've got 33 questions today, plus a tiebreaker. Tara, what's the steel meal situation?
Each of us has one steel meal.
All right. Can you please explain to Dave Roth what's involved with the steel meal?
Yes. Dave Roth, if Sarah or I answers a question incorrectly and you know it, before Dave gives the correct answer, you can jump in and say steel meal, and then you can steal the point.
Okay.
Steel meals.
On behalf of the valued guests.
All right. Let's throw it to the person in control choosing initiative, Picky 3000, to see who's going first today.
We will start with valued guest.
Oh, all right. So Dave is going first, followed by Tara, then Sarah. Are we ready to play A Rose by Any Other Name?
Yeah. I actually had a question. If we take the 2-point guess and we're wrong,
yeah, that's
are we
it.
Out?
I'm not giving any extra guesses. All right, here we go. Okay. Your name, give me the other name this person is known by. Your name, Dave Roth, Art Vandelay. Who is Art Vandelay and what show is he from?
George Costanza from Seinfeld.
And that is how you do it.
There we go.
Worth
good.
2 points.
All right.
Ronald Wilkerson. Tara. Ronald Wilkerson.
Ooh, hint.
That is from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
It's Titus.
It's Titus, yes. All right, to Sarah. Burt Macklin. Who is Burt Macklin?
Burt Macklin.
Burt
hint.
Macklin from Parks and Rec.
I don't know. Ron Swanson.
Steel Meal?
Steel Meal.
Did I do that right? Did I? It's,
you did.
It's Chris Pratt's character from Parks and Rec. I have to give the character's name, though, right?
Yes.
First name will do.
Andy. All right.
You got 1 point. All right. Nice steal.
Thanks. I have no more now, right?
That's
correct.
It's good, because I'm not going to know very many of these. I imagine they're going to
be
much harder.
Well, let's see. Let's test that theory. Here's your next one. Anastasia Beaverhausen.
That's a good one. I will need the hint.
All right. Anastasia Beaverhausen is from Will and Grace.
Oh, is it? Well, wait. I don't even remember her name. Megan Mullally's character? It doesn't matter. It's obviously not a correct answer.
You are correct in your incorrectness. It is Karen Walker, played by Megan.
Okay.
Tara Ariano.
Yes.
Regina Falangi.
That is Phoebe Buffay from Friends.
You are correct for 2 points. To Sarah D. Bunting. Bunting, that's you, Sarah.
Yep.
Templeton Peck. AKA.
Face from the A-Team.
Correct for 2 points.
Wow. Ew.
Back to other Dave. Janet Snakehole. Janet Snakehole.
Sounds like
I'm going to give you a little hint here.
It's Parks and Rec.
I'm
going
to give you a hint. An additional
hint.
You said
hint. The show.
Just hang
on. Is it Parks and
Rec? Hang on. Everybody.
Okay, I'm excited.
Hold your hair. We are talking about a show that's already appeared on this quiz. Show's going to appear multiple times. So with that, do you still want the show name?
No, I think I got it. It's I think that it's Aubrey Plaza's character from Parks and Rec, whose name I need to now try to remember. This is really exciting.
I'm going
to
give you the point for Parks and Rec.
All right, good. This is embarrassing that I can't remember.
It's
her
Andy
character.
And.
I might not know this. I gotta take the L.
It is April. April.
Embarrassing.
All right, Tatara. Yes. Cherith Cute Story.
I believe that's Michael Bluth from Arrested Development.
2 points. Sarah D. Bunting. Henry Gale.
Hint.
That is from Lost. Who is Henry Gale? AKA. I am accepting first names for most of this stuff.
Okay. I can picture the actor and I can't remember his name either.
Paint us a picture. What's he look like?
Little guy with little glasses?
Mm-hmm.
Is that Linus?
Yep.
Well, that's his last name, but we'll give it to you.
Get Benjamin Mr. Carey Preston.
Yeah. All right. Nice pull. That is good for 1 point. And here is Dave's.
Okay.
Herschel Kraskowski. Krastowski.
Oh, that's Krusty the Clown from The Simpsons.
You are correct, and that is worth 2 points. All right, that was question...
Jewish comedy legend, Herschel Kostofsky.
That is question 10, so...
We look at that. I got some 11.
Dan Silversmith.
Say again?
Dan Silversmith.
Hint.
30 Rock. Who is Dan Ooh. Silversmith?
God. I mean, I'm going to guess... Jack.
Dan Silversmith Tracy? Works for Carolina Mutual. That is Pete Hornberger at the end of the series, making his escape from married life. All right. Bring us into our first score break. Salvador Asante.
Hint.
Salvador Asante is from Entourage, better known as, or AKA at least.
Let's try the only character whose name I even know, Turtle.
Hey!
Good call. All right, that brings us into about third of the way in. Scores, please, Tara.
Very close game. Dave has 6 points. I have 5 points. Sarah has
4 points. That means, Sarah D. Bunting, guess what? You are yes. in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. He's got adequate lighting. He's got his glasses on. Let's do this, guys.
Okay.
The classics category. This very small print on these cards, guys. And I'm
this is
getting...
just for Sarah, Dave.
Yeah, just for Sarah. Classics. What Treasury agent was aided by sidekicks Youngblood, Rico, and Lee? And I have to ask the question, how many Treasury agents have been on TV?
Honestly.
Not a lot.
Not enough, in my opinion.
I don't know any.
Oh, I know,
you
know one.
Grandpa Buncey and her currency forger stories. Youngblood, Rico.
I have one, and I don't approve of his methods.
I don't know who this is. White Shadow.
This is Elliot Ness from The Untouchable.
Oh, yeah, him.
Oh, right.
All right, sitcom. What was the highest rated sitcom of the 70s? All in the Family or MASH?
Oh.
Joy.
All in the Family.
Next category, drama. What daytime soap had Carol Burnett telling TV Guide, I can't get through the day without it?
Oh, man. Shit. All My Children.
What?
Total guess.
All right. You got 3 questions left. You only need one of them to get the points. And those points are 4 points. What color is Captain Planet's skin? A strangely contemporary question for this mid-90s box set.
Captain Planet's skin
is what color?
Is, let's say blue.
Tom Cruise voiced Captain Planet has blue skin.
Oh!
It was more of a cyan, but, you know, we'll let it go. All right.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's just do these last two for shits and giggles. Stars. Who was listed for 2 years in Kojak's credits as George? No, let's not do it. Too many weird last names. All right, getting back to the game.
Would you like a new score?
Sure would.
Scores, Dave. Okay. I still have 5. Dave still has 6. Sarah is now in the lead with 8.
That is the power of the Equalizer Zone.
Yes.
We are back to Dave Roth. Here is your name. Tell me who he is also known as. We're talking about Oswald Cobblepot. What show? What character?
Oswald Cobblepot. I think I'm getting this confused with something from one of the movies, but I like the Penguin from the Batman series.
It is the Penguin. Right. I don't know if he was ever named as Oswald Cobblepot in Batman show,
but he was in Batman, whatever, the second Tim Burton.
Yeah. Thing. So, you know what? I'm just going to give you that point because I don't have time to research it. We definitely know he was Mr. Cobblepot. The show we were looking for was Gotham, but I suspect he was known as Cobblepot in a lot of the animated series of the 90s and the aughts. So the Game Master says 2 points.
Thank you. That's very gracious.
Tara Ariano, Norville Rogers. Norville Rogers.
Oh, God. Hint.
Scooby-Doo, where are you?
Maggie?
Shaggy, 1 point. Sarah D. Bunting, Blue Regard Q Kazoo. Blue Regard Q Kazoo.
Blue Regard Q Kazoo. I'm going to be super upset, but hint.
Foster's home for imaginary friends.
Blue.
Yay!
That was good for 1 point. Yes.
All right.
Back to Dave. It is Robin Sparkles. Robin Sparkles.
Robin Sparkles. Can you just say it again for me?
Yeah. Robin, like the bird, sparkles mm-hmm. like glittery stuff.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I should ask for a hint.
All right. The show, How I Met Your Mother.
Oh, it's going to be whatever.
Don't overthink it.
Neil Patrick Harris's character, which is named, I seldom watch the show. What is that character's name? Howard.
Robin Sparkles, Robin Scherbatsky. Robin, that was the answer.
Oh, that was his name. All right.
Number 17.
It was her. It was the lady.
It was her? Oh, yes. Okay. We're talking about Robin Sparkles now, right?
Yeah.
All right, great. Terrific.
Okay. Number 17, guys.
Freddie Eagle.
Thank you. Clive Bixby. Clive Bixby, a.k.a. Oh. also the show.
Yeah, hint.
Modern Family. Your favorite show with your favorite person.
Is this Phil?
Bill Dunphy for 1 point. To Sarah D. Bunting, Ronald McDonald. Ronald McDonald, yes. Spelled just like that.
Ronald
like the scary
McDonald.
Fast food clown.
Hint.
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh, Jesus. I don't know. D.
Mac is Ronald McDonald.
Ah.
Yeah. All right, this is 19, and it is for Dave Roth, Heisenberg. Heisenberg.
Oh, the this is the Breaking Bad, the Bryan Cranston character. I never watched that show. Is that bad?
It's Breaking Bad because you don't know what the character's name is.
I know. The I probably can. Oh, hang on. I don't know. The one that knocks.
Yep. The one that knocks.
Well, he gets 1 point, right?
He gets 1 point for Breaking Bad.
Yeah. I don't know
Walter White.
Not great.
Walter
yeah,
White.
Yeah, see, I definitely should have known that. Probably did know it, but it's tough.
Now
my brain doesn't work good no more. Yeah, I do, and I will never forget it.
Tara Ariano. Jeremy Bentham.
This is John Locke from Lost.
It is. Sarah D. Bunting, Winston Schmidt. Winston Schmidt.
Is this from New Girl? I'm asking. Oh, okay, great, because I'm not going to know the character, so I will take that 1 point and leave.
Guys, it frustrates me how you play the game sometimes. Just take a guess. Winston Schmidt.
I don't have a steal left.
No, you don't.
Schmidt?
Still, yeah.
Yeah,
see?
That one was... I think you would have been kicking yourself if you hadn't taken that shot.
Yeah.
Dave Roth, Gordon Shumway. Gordon Shumway. Who's...
Oh, that is Alf of Alf.
Alf of Alf. Well done. Tar Ariano.
See, you know characters who are important to you.
Yeah, I know characters that... right. If they're furry or if they're animated.
If only,
otherwise,
Walter, if only Walter White ate cats, you would know his name.
Or were in a basketball.
That's what I was going to say.
Cletus Van Damme. Tara. Cletus Van Damme.
Hint.
The Shield. Which you've never watched, so good luck.
I know one character on that show, and it's Vic Markey.
It's Shane Vandrell.
Oh, I think that's the Walton Goggins guy.
All right, this is going to bring us into our second score break. We are talking Alex Osborne. Alex Osborne.
Oh, Alex Osborne. Hint.
Community.
Oh, fuck's sake.
Alex Osborne,
Pierce.
Better known as
Pierce
Starburns. The guy was Starburns. Okay, we are to Dave Roth, your character, Jeff Albertson.
Oh, wait, is this a hint on the show, please?
The Simpsons. This is the real
Jeff
name.
Jeff Albertson.
Who, what character on The Simpsons?
I'm going through the different possibilities of who it could be. Is it Snake on The Simpsons?
Good guess. It is not, though. It is the comic book guy. The comic.
Oh, all right. I was thinking the cat, the sea captain.
Yeah.
Tari Ariano.
Disco Stewart.
Roy Hinckley.
God Roy damn Hinckley. It. Hint.
Gilligan's Island.
Oh. The Professor?
That's good for a point.
Oh, all right.
Nice.
Sarah D. Bunting. George Maharis.
George Maharis. Can I have a hint, please?
Yeah, you... May. The show is Arrested Development. You got a lot of characters to choose from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say that there is a hint in the name there. George Maharis.
George Michael?
Nice.
George Michael Bluth. That is good for 1 point. Okay. This is for Mr. Roth, Agent Michael Skarn.
Ooh. Skarn. I'm going to need a hint on the show.
The Office.
Well, that makes it a little bit easier. Is it Michael Scott?
It is Michael Office? Scott, yes.
All right.
I believe you. That was his threat level midnight character. Yastrepa Gronkowitz. Yastrepa Gronkowitz, Tara.
I feel like I know this one too. Hint.
30 Rock.
Fuck. Is it
guest alias
Jenna?
It is Jenna. That's good. Nice. For 1 point. To Sarah, Duke Silver. Duke Silver.
I really Duke? Want to say that it's Duke Lavery, but I know it isn't. Hint.
Is this worse than jazz?
The show, Parks and Rec.
Is this Ron Swanson?
This is Ron Swanson, his saxophone playing alter ego, Dude Silver. All right, everybody's last question coming up, so let's get a quick score break.
Okay, I am in last place with 11 points. Dave has 12. Sarah has 13.
Done!
All right, pay attention, guys. Last question's coming at you, starting with Dave's Richard Dick Whitman.
Oh, this is good. This is, I was going to say John Hamm from Mad Men, but I actually
classic Roth.
I remember the character's name. It's Don Draper.
Yes. And that is good for 2 points, putting you in the lead by one. Tara's Samuel Powers. Samuel Powers. A.K.A.
Kent.
Saved by the Bell.
Zach?
Screech. Screech.
Oh, right. Of course.
Duh. Sarah D. Bunting, 1 to tie, 2 to win. Clark Westerfeld.
Clark Westerfeld.
Yes. So she's going to go for the win. She's going to ask for a hint. Hope for the tie.
I'm just gonna go for it.
All right, here we go. This... I like this. Oh, wait. All right, everybody get ready. All right, here we go. Do it.
Is this Clark on Smallville?
No, swung for the fences, but did not hit the ball. That is Tara.
That's one of the most famous aliases of Philip from The Americans.
The Americans.
Of Clark,
yes.
And Martha.
Did not watch that. Sorry.
All right, that means, a come from behind victory from Mr. Roth, putting
guess
on the board. Before we make this official and have our victory dance, let's do what was going to be the tiebreaker for a steel meal for future use, okay?
Okay.
I am going to read you the name in question. If you happen to know the answer, I want the character's name involved, okay? If you happen to know it, spit it out and you win, but I'll start reading stuff about him, all right? And as soon as you know the answer, or you think you know the answer, shout it out. So let's see if anybody knows this character from the get-go. Jonas Grumby. Jonas Grumby. Little was ever learned about his past, but in several episodes, he mentions having several ships blown out from under him.
It's the skipper from Gilligan's Island.
Yes, it is the skipper from Gilligan's Island. You are correct, and you get another steel mill, but...
Valued guest.
Good job, Dave.
Excellent
well done.
Work, Dave.
Wow.
Yes.
Hey, thank you, guys. I appreciate that very much. I do have some remarks prepared.
People you'd like to thank? Walter White?
My
apology?
Yeah, Walter. The actor, Bryan Cranston. The actor, Aubrey Plaza. All the great actors and the great characters that they created that I forgot about.
Doesn't matter because you won.
Yeah, I know. It feels great. That's so true. It's the most American thing I ever heard.
That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We drove Christine to Maine for the debut of the King of Earth show Castle Rock before going around the dial with stops at 70-Year Switch, Bosch, Last Chance U, and Stephen King's Bad Credit. Dave Roth made the successful pitch for the Bonkers SUV animal trapping episode Wildlife for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Dave was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
artist Tri Chump,
Sarah D. Bunting,
please run, please,
and Dave Roth.
I'm in a basketball.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Check out the hyena vomit.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv podcast network.
All right. Ad break two.
To apply for a card, look for an application and complete it.
Yep.
Cross your fingers.
Slow down. Slow down.
There was, yeah, seriously. In English, doctor.
There was, this is off show still, but when I worked in high school, when I worked at the gas station, you know, they had all the credit card, those applications and those, you know, acrylic holders. And there's this one guy would come every week and take every single one and throw them all in the mailbox because they're all prepaid. He'd be like, that'll show them. And he did it like every week. And like nobody stopped him. Like, who gives a shit? Like, you know, nobody makes money off of that except the credit card. It was so weird. Like, that was his personal crusade.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh.
That's like, that is like online activism before online activism existed. Where it's like, what is the simplest, like, no cost thing that I could do to possibly, like, annoy a brand?
American Express and MasterCard and Visa are going down 32 cents at a time. That was his. Yep. Yeah.